Indeed, I told the House of Commons, as you may remember, almost exactly a fortnight ago, that the worst possibilities were open. And I made it perfectly clear that whatever happened in France would make no difference to the resolve of Britain and the British Empire to fight on. As I then said, if necessary to yearn, if necessary alone. During the last 2 days, we had successfully brought off the great majority of the troops we had on the lines of communication in France. And 7/8 of all the troops we have sent to France since the beginning of the war, that is to say about 350,000 out of 400,000 men, are safely back in this country. Others are still fighting with the French. We have also brought back a great mass of stores, rifles, and munitions of all kinds, which had been accumulated in France during the last 9 months. We have therefore in this island today a very large and powerful military force. This force includes all our best trained troops and our finest troops, including scores of thousands of those who have already measured their quality against the Germans and found themselves at no disadvantage. We have under arms at the present time in this island over a million and a quarter men. Behind these, we have the local defense volunteers, numbering 500,000. Only a portion of whom, however, are yet armed with rifles or other firearms. We have incorporated into our defense forces every man to whom we have a weapon. We expect very large additions to our weapons in the near future. And in preparation for this, we intend forthwith to call up, drill, and train further large numbers. Those who are not called up, or else are employed upon the vast business of munitions production in all its branches, and their ramifications are innumerable. Those who are not so employed or required will serve the country best by remaining at their ordinary work until they receive their summons. We have also over here the Dominion Army. The Canadians have actually landed in France, but have now been safely withdrawn. They were much disappointed, but in perfect order with all their artillery and equipment. And both these very high-class forces from the Dominion will now take part in the defense of the mother country. The last account I have given of these large forces we have in this country should raise the question, why did they not intervene in the Battle of France? I must make it clear that apart from the divisions training and organizing upon, only 12 divisions were equipped to fight upon the scale which justified their being sent abroad. And this was fully up to the number which the French had been led to expect would be available at the 9th month of the war. The rest of our forces have a fighting value for home defense, which will, of course, steadily increase with every week that passes. Thus, the invasion of Great Britain would at this time require the transportation across the sea of hostile armies on a very large scale. And after they had been transported, they would have to be continually maintained with all the immense mass of munitions and supplies which are required for continuous battle. And continuous battle it will surely be. Now here is where we come to the Navy. And after all, we have a Navy. Some people are inclined to forget that we have a Navy. For more than 30 years, I've been concerned in discussions about the possibilities of overseas invasion. And I took the responsibility on behalf of the Admiralty at the beginning of the last war of allowing all the regular troops to be sent out of the country.
That was a very serious step to take, because our territorials had only just been called up and were quite untrained. Therefore, this island was for several months practically denuded of fighting troops. The Admiralty of those days had confidence in their ability to prevent a mass invasion. And you must remember that at that time, the Germans had a magnificent battle fleet, a fleet in the proportion of 10 ships of theirs to 16 of ours, and capable of fighting a general engagement any day. Whereas now they have only two heavy ships worth speaking of, the Scharnhorst and the Neisenau. So the situation is very much less critical than the one we lived through in the beginning of the last war. And it seems to me that so far as seaborne invasion on a great scale is concerned, we are far more capable of meeting it today than we were at many periods in the last war, and during the early months of this war also, before our other troops were trained, and while the BES had proceeded abroad. Now, the Navy have never pretended to be able to prevent raids by bodies of 5,000 or 10,000 men flung suddenly across and thrown ashore at several points of the coast some dark night or foggy morning. The efficacy of sea power, and especially under modern conditions, depends upon the invading force being of a large size, so that the Navy have something they can find and meet, and as it were, something they can bite on. Now, even 5 divisions, very lightly equipped, would require 200 to 250 ships. And with the modern air reconnaissance and photography, it would not be easy to collect such an armada, marshal it, and conduct it across the sea without any powerful naval force to escort it. And there would be very great possibilities, put it mildly, that this armada would be intercepted long before it reached the coast, and all the men drowned in the sea, or at the worst, blown to pieces with their equipment while they were trying to land. There are also a great system of minefields, recently strongly reinforced, to which we alone know the channel. If the enemy tries to seek passages through these minefields, it will be the task of the Navy to destroy the mine sweepers and any other force employed to protect them. There ought to be no difficulty in this, owing to our great superiority of speed. The question is whether there are any new methods by which these solid assurances can be circumvented. Odd as it may seem, some attention has been given to this by the Admiralty, whose prime duty and responsibility it is to destroy any large seaborne expedition before it reaches, or at the moment it reaches, east shore. It wouldn't be a good thing for me to go into details of this. I might put something in their minds which they haven't thought of, and perhaps they wouldn't make any answer which would put something in our minds that we haven't thought of. All I will say is that untiring vigilance and untiring searching of the mind is being and must be devoted to the subject. Because remember, the enemy is crafty, cunning, and full of novel treacheries and stratagems. There is no dirty trick he will not do. This brings me to the great question of invasion from the air. And of the impending struggle between the British and German air forces. It seems quite clear that no invasion on its scale beyond the capacity of our land forces to crush speedily, no invasion on a scale beyond that is likely to take place until our air force has been definitely overpowered. In the meantime, there may be raids by parachute troops and attempted descent by airborne soldiers. We ought to be able to give these gentry a warm reception, both in the air and also if they reach the ground in any condition to continue the discussion. But the great question is, Can we break Hitler's air weapons? Now, of course, it is a very great pity that we have not got an air force at least equal to that of the most powerful enemy within reach of our shores. We were promised that 5 years ago. But we have a very powerful air force, which has proved itself far superior in quality, both in men and in many types of machines, to anything we have met so far in the numerous and fierce air battles which have been fought with the Germans. In France, where we were at a considerable disadvantage and lost a lot of machines on the ground when they were standing round the aerodrome, in France, we were accustomed to inflict in the air a loss of 2 to 2.5 to 1. In the fighting over Dunkirk, which was a sort of no man's land, we undoubtedly beat the German Air Force and gained the mastery of the local air, inflicting here a loss of 3 or 4 to 1, day after day. Anyone who looked at the photographs, you must remember them, of the re-embarkation about 10 days ago, great photographs in all the papers, showing the masses of troops assembled upon the beaches, forming the ideal target for hours at a time. Anyone who looked at them must realize that this could not have been possible. That the re-embarkation of all these men could never have been achieved unless the enemy had resigned all hope of recovering air superiority at that time and at that place. In the defense of this island, the advantages of the defenders will be much greater than they were in the fighting around Dunkirk. We hope to improve upon the rate of 3 or 4 to 1, which was realized at Dunkirk, and in addition, all injured machines and their crews would get down safely, which are a great many in air fighting, surprisingly. Quite a large number come to ground without being permanently injured, and quite a large number of the men come to ground safely. If they fall on friendly soil, they live to fight another day. Whereas all the injured enemy machines and all the men who man them will be total losses as far as the war is concerned. During the great battle in France, we gave very powerful continuous aid to the French army, both by fighters and by bombers. But in spite of every kind of pressure, we would never allow the entire metropolitan strength of the Air Force and fighters to be consumed. This decision was painful, but it was also right, because the fortunes of the battle in France could not have been decisively influenced, even if we had thrown in our entire air fighter force. That great battle was lost by the unfortunate strategic opening, by the extraordinary unforeseen power of the armored column, and by the very great German preponderance in number. Our fighter air force might easily have been exhausted as a mere incident in that conflict, and then we should have found ourselves at the present time in a serious plight indeed.